Travelers caught a glimpse of a sizable settlement and of the first dwellings that had the appearance of being permanent houses. It was the first real settlement the wanderers had encountered since leaving Florida. The castaways had reached an agricultural oasis in the midst of a sea of nomads. The captives' village turned out to be part of a cluster of settlements located at the confluence of the Rio Grande and the Rio Conchos, an area aptly known today as La Junta de los Rios, the juncture of the rivers, between Presidio, Texas, and Ojinaga, Chihuahua. Almost 50 years after Cabeza de Vaca's visit, another Spanish expedition, headed by a Mexico City merchant named Antonio de Espejo, went through La Junta area and counted 5 pueblos and more than 10,000 inhabitants living in flat-roofed houses. Espejo learned another interesting fact. The residents told him that 3 Christians and a Negro had passed through there. Espejo immediately concluded that such visitors could only have been Alonso Núñez Cabeza de Vaca, Dorantes, Castillo Maldonado, and a Negro, who had all escaped from the fleet with which Panfilo Narváez entered Florida. The Indians at La Junta de los Rios were farmers. The damp islands and bays formed by the rivers were propitious for the farming of corn, beans, and squash. Cabeza de Vaca and his companions quickly learned that these Indians possessed corn, and this was the thing that gladdened us more than anything else in the world, and for this we gave infinite thanks to our Lord. By the time of the castaways' visit, these Indians had occupied the river juncture continuously for around 3 centuries. They would continue to cling tenaciously to the area until their final amalgamation to Spanish society in the 18th century. Their centuries-old history has been largely lost, but it is not too difficult to imagine the tribulations of an agricultural island and strategic crossroad of exchange where hunter-gatherers of the southern Great Plains, merchants from the southwest, and travelers from the Gulf of Mexico region converged. These people, known variously to the Spaniards as Humanos, Patarabueyes, and Rayados, had to adapt and shift to survive, at times aligning themselves closely with the centers of the Southwest, and at other times strengthening their ties to the nomads of the plains. Regardless of the dominant cultural elements, they always straddled the divide between the settled and the nomadic worlds. The material possessions of the Indians of La Junta revealed the extent to which they inhabited both worlds. On the one hand, Cabeza de Vaca and his companions were impressed by the obvious signs of village life, such as the sturdy houses that overlooked their cornfields. Unlike the portable skin tents that the castaways themselves had been using for years, the people at La Junta de los Rios lived in spacious square structures, anchored with pillars as thick as a man's thigh, and with walls plastered with mud. On the other hand, this same people seemed to lack such essentials as pots. To boil water, they resorted to filling gourds with water and throwing hot stones into them. And then they would add the bean meal and put more stones on top until the pap or porridge was cooked, and then they would eat it. They were also astonishingly mobile, and periodically embarked on lengthy expeditions to trade and hunt buffalo. And we called them the people of the cows, Cabeza de Vaca explains, because the greatest number of those cows are killed near there. And upstream along that river for more than 50 leagues, they go killing many of them. Cabeza de Vaca, Dorantes, Castillo, and Estebanico stayed in these settlements for some weeks, surely contemplating their achievements, and wondering how their journey would end. Their breathtaking gamble of forsaking Panuco and venturing inland seemed to have paid off. By letting go and allowing themselves to be driven along by throngs of Indians, they had traveled halfway across the continent. They had seen many peoples and had covered much ground that no other outsider had seen before, getting closer to the Indians with metallurgical knowledge. The 4 men must have been humbled, however, by the enormous and eerie land ahead of them. They asked the people of the cows about the country to the west and were told that there was a great deal of corn there. In fact, for 2 years in a row, the rains had not come to La Junta de los Ríos. The people of the cows had lost their crops and had been forced to import corn from the land to the west. The wanderers must have been delighted to know that ahead of them lived peoples who were in possession of great stores of corn, but they also learned that this land of plenty was very distant, and it would be difficult to get there. They would have to start by following the river, most likely the Rio Grande, upstream for 17 days, where they would find nothing to eat except for a certain fruit that grew in trees that the Indians called mazarrones, and that had to be crushed with rocks. Even then, they were told, it was very bad stuff, not even fit for animals. After pondering their options for 2 more days, the foursome decided to follow the trail of the maize. And the fear they put into us about the great hunger that we were to endure, which in truth we suffered all the 17 days' journey about which they had told us, was not sufficient to stop us from doing this. The trekkers ascended the river. They did not eat the unpalatable mazarrones, but subsisted instead on daily rations of deer fat. They needed the calories badly, and there was nothing else to be had. As they proceeded upriver, the explorers found empty Indian camps. Most of the regular occupants had gone north to hunt bison, but the few Indians who stayed behind were friendly, allowing the expeditioners to sleep in the empty huts and giving them bison robes and other things. On the 17th day, Cabeza de Vaca and his companions stopped following the river and veered west. They were traveling with some natives who told them where to go. The medicine men walked another 17 or 20 days through a high plain. The vast landscape was broken only by stands of creosote, yucca, and mesquite. In the distance, the majestic Sierra Madre Occidental loomed interminably from south to north, completely blocking their way. They reached the foothills of the massive range, and their Indian hosts steered them through passes that gave way to even higher and more desert-like tablelands. Somehow, the sources provide precious few clues, the group was able to negotiate the continental divide, eventually reaching the Pacific slopes of the mighty Sierra. The entire area was fringed by mountains crowned with pine trees. The cold must have been unbearable at night, as the dreaded winter approached once again. The castaways must have passed very near the ancient city of Paquimé, Casas Grandes, or Big Houses, once a cultural center of the first magnitude. Between 1250 and 1450, Paquimé had dominated a vast realm, controlling outposts stretching as far away as La Junta de los Ríos to the east and the Pacific coast to the west. The people of Paquimé were consummate merchants. They had been the preeminent importers of live scarlet macaws, copper bells and shells, and the greatest exporters of turquoise into central Mexico. The city itself, first described by a European party of exploration in the 1550s, appeared compact but extremely dense. It boasted structures that were as high as 6 or 7 stories. According to an account of this expedition, Paquimé could well have been constructed by the ancient Romans. It possessed towers and walls like fortresses, and magnificent patios paved with enormous and beautiful stones resembling jasper. Yet Paquimé became depopulated and was finally destroyed and burned to the ground sometime around 1450 or 1500, only 2 or 3 generations before the passage of Cabeza de Vaca's party. The great city and its surroundings were by then inhabited by recent arrivals, nomads, who did not so much live in the ruined stone houses as camp in them. The erstwhile residents of Paquimé had scattered in all directions, moving into a constellation of modest villages that, in all likelihood, were some of the settlements that the castaways encountered every 2 or 3 days, and where they rested as they made their way to the Pacific coast. After 2 or 3 months of arduous marches, the 3 Spaniards and the African at last arrived at the land of maize. sometime in late 1535 or early 1536. They ventured into a region of many villages boasting permanent houses and large stores of maize. The four healers were given corn flour and beans and squash. "And we loaded those who brought us there," Cabeza de Vaca says, "and with this they went home the most contented people in the world." The castaways walked for 300 miles or more without ever leaving the maize country. The four wanderers must have been traveling through the fertile valleys of northern Sonora, already on the Pacific slopes of the Sierra Madre Occidental. The Indians there lived in permanent houses and wore shoes, and the women wore cotton shirts all the way to their knees and long deerskin skirts that touched the ground. They appeared to the four men to be the most decently clad women we had ever seen in any part of the Indies. They continued to cure, and in return received many rich presents, including cotton mantles, better than those of New Spain, beads and corals from the Pacific Ocean, fine turquoises from the north, and what was described as emeralds made into arrowheads. But the most extravagant gift that they received was a bundle of more than 600 hearts of deer, split open through the middle and dried. For that reason, the adventurers called that village Corazones, or hearts. Throughout the land of maize, the people had flocked to the strangers, asking to be touched and to have the sign of the cross made over them. The ill and the healthy alike approached the healers, and even the women who had just given birth took their babies to be blessed. The Indians following the four men numbered 1,500 and could reach up to 3,000 or more. The four medicine men sought to enhance their authority by speaking as little as possible, communicating mostly through the African Estebanico, an arrangement that must have seemed impressive to the Indians. While the three Spaniards remained aloof and forbidding, Estebanico was gregarious and easygoing. He was the one who informed himself about the roads and villages ahead. His gift for languages and communication through signs was tested to the limit. Even though the healers were now able to speak six indigenous languages among them, they were of little use in a land where so many tongues were heard. And among all these peoples, it was taken for certain that we came from the sky, Cabeza de Vaca writes, because all the things that they do not have or do not know the origin of, they say, come from the sky. The Indians would come out at sunrise, raising their hands to the sky, and then running them over the strangers' bodies. The four wanderers' ascendancy over the natives was so great that they could not help but think about how to use it to advance Spain's imperial aims. Instead of bringing the Indians into the Christian fold through violence, the healers dreamed of accomplishing this grandiose project peacefully and humanely. Since Narváez was dead, Cabeza de Vaca and the others may have considered the possibility of going back to Spain to obtain his adelantamiento. For the moment, they did what they could, as Cabeza de Vaca says, and we told them by signs, because they understood us, that in heaven there was a man, whom we called God, who had created the heaven and the earth, and that we adored him and served him as Lord, and that we did whatever he commanded us, and that from his hand came all good things, and if thus they were to do it, it would go very well for them. The healers may have been humane, but they were also 16th century Christians. They believed that the throngs of Indians that showed so much reverence and devotion toward them would be infinitely better off as Catholics under Spanish rule. The castaways thus intended to forge a Christian kingdom out of these untamed lands. Unfortunately, their dreams would soon collide with a different kind of kingdom, one of brutality and greed. Around Christmas of 1535, Castillo spotted a Spanish buckle and a horseshoe nail tied around the neck of an Indian in the manner of jewels. It was a small detail that he could easily have overlooked, but once he spotted the necklace, he must have been overcome with excitement. He took the buckle and the nail and asked the man where they had come from. The Indian responded that they belonged to some men who wore beards like us, who had come from the sky and arrived at that river and who brought horses and lances and swords, and who had lanced two of them. Trying not to appear too eager, the medicine men inquired further about the activities of these Europeans. They were told that the foreigners had been seen by the coast. The survivors had decidedly mixed feelings about hearing the news that there were conquistadors not far from where they were. On the one hand, they were grateful to God because they appeared at last to be at the very doorstep of deliverance. Almost a decade of hardship, privation, and uncertainty seemed to be coming to an end. But on the other, they felt greatly disturbed and saddened that other Christians had already reached these remote lands and were causing so much harm to the natives. These conquistadors had destroyed towns throughout the area and had captured men, women, and children. The medicine men promised their Indian hosts that they would look for these men and try to get them to stop killing and enslaving the natives. The Indians of the maize were greatly pleased at hearing this promise. Chapter 9. Contact. Even by the dismal standards of Spain's early involvement in the New World, the bearded conquistadors who had left Mexico City and made their way up through the Pacific coast were notorious. Nuño de Guzmán and his men exercised a level of violence that has few equivalents in the dark annals of conquest. By 1536, Guzmán's grim reputation was quite well known. For nearly a decade, he had been the master of Panuco, amassing a fortune through the enslavement of natives and their sale in the Caribbean. The scope of his slaving activities had been momentarily threatened by Panfilo de Narváez's projected occupation of the large area north of Panuco. Of course, Narváez's arrival never materialized, leaving the field wide open to the enterprising Guzmán. After securing his hold over Panuco, Nuño de Guzmán moved to Mexico City. The crown intended to make out of this audacious nobleman an effective counterweight to the headstrong Hernán Cortés. In 1528, Guzmán received an appointment as president of the First Audiencia of Mexico, the second highest-ranking official in the land. His backers were not disappointed, as Guzmán used every opportunity to loosen Cortés's grip and wage a bureaucratic war on his allies. But his tenure was tumultuous, with allegations of mismanagement, widespread slaving, and extortion prompting his excommunication by the bishop-elect of Mexico. Just prior to Christmas of 1529, under a cloud of ruthless maneuvering and illegality, Nuño de Guzmán left Mexico City at the head of 400 Spaniards and as many as 12,000 Indian porters and auxiliaries. They were bound for the unexplored lands to the north and west, where they hoped to find even greater kingdoms than those of central Mexico. Guzmán, not unlike his arch-rival Cortés, intended to redeem himself by fiat. Guzmán's expedition left a trail of desolation wherever it went. On its way to the Pacific coast, it passed through the great kingdom of Michoacán. There, Nuño de Guzmán and his men tortured and executed Casonsi, the native ruler, for failing to deliver enough tribute. This powerful lord, deemed to be as great as Moctezuma and even richer in gold and silver, was dragged by a horse, strangled with a garrote, and burned at the stake. It was an outrage that Casonsi's subjects could scarcely begin to comprehend. Before leaving Michoacán, Guzmán demanded an additional 8,000 Indians for the expedition. Many of them were put in chains or wore collars around their necks. By the summer of 1530, Guzmán's party had reached the indigenous province of Aztatlán, a thin strip of hot country along the Pacific coast between the Santiago and Culiacán rivers in northwest Mexico. The onset of the rainy season finally halted its advance. The showers would soon become so torrential that the Indians were forced to leave their huts and climb up in trees. From their high perches, they could not see land, but only an ocean of mud. Toads jumped through the camp. Most expedition members fell ill, and out of 8,000 Indians, there were not 200 who remained standing. The natives who were strong enough attempted to flee this watery hell, but many were instead caught and tortured. Guzman ordered the construction of a large pen. Inside, Indian men were held in place with steel collars. The women were tied with ropes in groups of 10, and the small children were confined in groups of 5. At the center of this brutal activity was the contradictory Guzman. In his own way, he was a very religious man who professed a special devotion to the Holy Spirit. He had a puritanical streak, evident in his intolerance toward those Spaniards who kept Indian concubines or uttered blasphemies in his presence, practices that must have been nearly impossible to eradicate in the rough-and-tumble world of conquistadors. His megalomania reached such immense proportions that he insisted that Indians sweep the streets and roads ahead of him. At times he seemed downright delusional. He was among the most enthusiastic believers in the existence of Amazons farther up on the Pacific coast, of a land where women only tolerated the presence of men at certain times of the year. His rigid and perhaps even pathological personality aside, Nuño de Guzmán was a bold strategist bent on uniting his holdings on the Gulf of Mexico and the Pacific coast, and a shrewd businessman who knew how to keep his men loyal by lavishing authority and slaves on them. Most importantly, the Crown's strong backing enabled Guzmán to continue to dream about Amazons and vast new kingdoms. In the early 1530s, Guzman's haphazard conquests hardened into a permanent new province called Nueva Galicia. The Empress herself sent Guzman a congratulatory letter naming him governor. With the passage of time, Guzman's drab military camps became cities and ports ruled by his associates. Nueva Galicia comprised a large coastal region from the present-day states of Jalisco all the way to Sonora. At the far end of this province, cavalry detachments continued to explore further into the north. Captain Diego de Alcaraz led one of these units. His efforts were chiefly devoted to finding and enslaving Indians. These mounted Spaniards faced an entire continent teeming with Indians who could not move faster than their own legs would carry them. Even half a dozen European horsemen could turn into an extremely efficient enslaving machine. And they did. Small detachments fanned out, actively burning villages and ruining crops and carrying off men, women, and children. At first, perhaps out of natural curiosity, Indians would approach the slavers, but they learned quickly. And by the mid-1530s, they had abandoned their cornfields and dwellings on the more accessible coastal locations to take refuge in the myriad crevices of the Sierra Madre Occidental. The slavers were thus forced into ever more difficult and unsuccessful searches. This is the world that Cabeza de Vaca, Dorantes, Castillo, and Estebanico encountered as they descended the sierras and headed toward the coast. From the village of Corazones, the castaways traveled with an entourage to another town, where the heavy rains forced them to stop the march for 2 weeks. After another trek of 240 miles, they reached the Rio Sinaloa. In the vicinity of that river, the four men found a spot where Europeans had recently spent the night. The signs were unmistakable. The camp had stakes where the horses had been tied. Some Indian guides had actually seen how the Spanish slavers transported many Indians using chains. And those who came with us, Cabeza de Vaca says, were very disturbed by this. That very night, the royal treasurer vowed to make contact with the horsemen. He asked one of his younger and stronger companions to rush ahead with a few Indians to overtake the Spaniards, but the man, probably Dorantes, excused himself, saying that it would be too difficult and tiresome. So the next morning, Cabeza de Vaca set out to do it himself. He took Estebanico and 11 Indians and began tracking the Christians. The men exerted themselves to the limit, covering almost 30 miles in a single day and passing through no less than 3 abandoned Christian encampments. It must have been April 1536, almost 9 years since the survivors had left Europe. The following morning, Cabeza de Vaca's party came within sight of four Christian horsemen. From a distance, the 13 men, walking barefoot and clad in skins, must have seemed rather ordinary, except for their boldness in moving straight toward the horsemen. At closer range, the disconcerting details must have become visible. First, Estebanico's skin color, and then Cabeza de Vaca himself. His hair dropped down to his waist, and his beard reached to his chest. When the two parties came face to face, and the white man spoke in perfect Andalusian Spanish, the slavers were dumbfounded. "They remained looking at me for a long time," Cabeza de Vaca writes, "so astonished that they neither spoke to me nor managed to ask me anything." The initial exchange must have been awkward, but the men agreed to walk together for another 1.5 miles to meet Captain Diego de Alcaraz, who was encamped with the rest of his men, altogether about 20 horsemen, by the Rio Sinaloa. Alcaraz was angry because his unit had been unable to take Indian captives. For 2 weeks, the slavers hadn't even seen any Indians. The arrival of Cabeza de Vaca and Estebanico was shocking and impossible to explain, but at least they had brought some natives. What Cabeza de Vaca said next could not have failed to ignite Alcaraz's imagination. The royal treasurer explained that about 30 miles away, two other Spaniards had stayed behind, and that they were waiting with many people who had guided them. Alcaraz and his men must have struggled to conceal their anticipation at the thought of so many potential captives. The group then formulated a plan. Estebanico would go back to guide the two remaining castaways into Captain Alcaraz's camp. He was ordered to depart immediately with a posse of 3 Spanish horsemen and about 50 Indian porters. Estebanico must have sensed that his status was diminishing quickly. Through many hardships and adventures across North America, the African had emerged as a full partner of the 3 Europeans. Lately, he had served as their principal scout and as an intermediary between the Indians of the Land of Maize and the 3 Spaniards. Unquestionably, Estebanico had been essential to the band's survival. But upon reaching Christian-dominated lands, whatever equality he had been able to achieve evaporated rapidly. The Spanish horseman must not have given a second thought to his condition as a slave. Even his fellow castaways had started to reassert their authority. Cabeza de Vaca himself takes for granted the Moroccan's opinion when, after getting the first inklings of the presence of Christians, he writes coldly that he took the black man with him to search for them. Estebanico received orders from the white men, and he obeyed them. It must have been a difficult transformation for someone who had been so revered by the Indians. 5 days later, Estebanico returned, leading Dorantes, Castillo, and more than 600 Indians who had been hiding from the slavers, but now insisted on staying with the castaways. No longer angry about the dearth of natives, Captain Alcaraz now worried about his food stores. He begged Cabeza de Vaca to call on the Indians who had been hiding in the mountains to bring some corn, but this was not necessary, Cabeza de Vaca says, because they always took care to bring us all they could. And we then sent out our messengers to call them, and 600 additional people came who brought us all the maize they could obtain. Even though the Indians had not been able to sow, they had placed their leftover corn in clay pots, sealed them, and buried them. The natives took these pots to the castaways, who ate what they wanted and gave the rest to the slavers. The Indians must have been perplexed by this behavior, but they remained confident in the 4 medicine men. With their bellies full, the survivors and the horsemen finally quarreled. Between the 600 Indians who had brought Estebanico and the other 600 who had brought the corn, there must have been more than 1,000 natives around the Spanish camp. The castaways had promised them that they would get the slavers to stop their depredations, and here was their chance. Cabeza de Vaca laid out his vision of prosperity for all. Never prone to wordiness or exaggeration, he curtly informed the horsemen that this coastal area was without a doubt the best of any to be found in these Indies, and the most fertile and abundant in foodstuffs. It was so rich, he claimed, that Indians sowed 3 times a year and gathered many fruits, and there were beautiful rivers and many other good waterways, and many indications of gold and silver mines, even if the Indians did not care for these metals. As for the people, Cabeza de Vaca said, they were well-disposed and of very good inclinations. In short, there was nothing lacking for Christians and Indians alike to prosper in such a privileged environment. Making use of all the authority he could muster as royal treasurer of the Florida expedition, Cabeza de Vaca must have indicated to the slavers that they had erred in having entered the land to wage indiscriminate war on the natives. The result was plain to see. The land had been abandoned, the fields were overgrown with vegetation, and the Indians had taken refuge in the mountains, making life for the Spaniards themselves very difficult. But Cabeza de Vaca had a solution. The castaways had given ample proof of their great influence over the Indians. Now they offered to call out to the Indians to resettle the land and restore the lost Eden. Cabeza de Vaca had already broached the subject with the Indians, and they had said that they would go back to their old houses and fields if the Christians would only promise that all would live in peace. The Spanish horsemen were unimpressed by Cabeza de Vaca's vision. They saw a human cargo worth a fortune standing around them. They had not lived among the Indians like the castaways had, and could not begin to fathom the utopian project proposed by this Spaniard gone native who believed in his mysterious powers to cure. The conversation deteriorated, and we suffered greatly and had great disputes with them, Cabeza de Vaca says, because they wanted to enslave the Indians we had brought with us. In a last-ditch effort to save them, Cabeza de Vaca commanded the Indians to disperse, but they refused to go. The natives fully intended to turn the strangers over to another group, as was their custom, and believed that they would die if they failed to do so. As long as the castaways stayed with them, they feared neither the Christians nor their lances. The Spanish horsemen became very annoyed, and through some interpreters they let the Indians know that the 4 survivors were Christians like themselves. The Indians refused to believe it. Their eloquent rebuttal resonates today, reminding us that not all Spanish expeditions were the same. They said, Cabeza de Vaca remembers, that we came from where the sun rose, and they from where it set, that we cured the sick, and they killed those who were well, that we came naked and barefoot, and they went about dressed and on horses and with lances, and that we did not covet anything, but rather everything they gave us, we later returned and remained with nothing. And that the others had no other objective but to steal everything they found and did not give anything to anyone. At last the castaways were taken away with some of the Indians in great haste. But they left behind many bows and leather pouches, and the 5 emerald arrows, which must have fallen into the hands of Captain Alcaraz and his men. Under a Spanish guard, the Florida expeditioners headed toward Culiacan, the northernmost Spanish town, which was still 90 miles away. The irony of the situation was not lost on Cabeza de Vaca, for we went to them, the Spaniards seeking liberty, and when we thought we had it, it turned out to be so much to the contrary. Cruelly, the Spanish guard took the castaways through overgrown and depopulated areas to remove us from conversation with Indians along the way, Cabeza de Vaca says. The thickets were dense and nearly impassable, and there were no roads. They found no water for 2 days, and we all thought that we would perish from thirst, and 7 men died from it, and many Indian friends. At Culiacan, the 4 wanderers were presented to the alcalde mayor and captain of the province, Melchor Díaz. He must have been astonished to learn that his guests were the last survivors of the ill-fated expedition of Panfilo de Narváez to Florida. And he wept a great deal with us, praising God our Lord for having shown so much mercy to us, Cabeza de Vaca writes. And he spoke to us and treated us very well. And on behalf of the governor, Nuño de Guzmán, as well as his own, he offered us everything that he had and could. The alcalde mayor conveyed his sorrow at the bad treatment the four survivors had suffered at the hands of Captain Alcaraz and his men, and wished he had been there to prevent it. The four healers spent some weeks at Culiacán, making contact with the Indians of the area and trying to persuade them to return to the coastal plains to plant corn. These efforts were consistent with the castaways' vision of a kingdom of cooperation, but such a realm depended on the promise that Spaniards would cease to make war on the Indians, a promise that neither Cabeza de Vaca nor the others could enforce. Unfortunately, they soon learned that the horsemen by the Rio Sinaloa had resumed their slaving raids, and that the newly resettled Indians had become their targets. On May 16, 1536, the castaways began their march toward Compostela, the capital of Nueva Galicia, where Nuño de Guzmán awaited. The four healers were accompanied now by just a few dozen Indians. The group of about 80 was driven by a guard of 20 horsemen. All of them were trailed not by throngs of adoring Indians, but by 500 Indian slaves who were probably in chains. On the way, they witnessed the ravages of the Spanish entrada along the Pacific seaboard. In a stretch that extended for 300 miles or more, Cabeza de Vaca says, "The country is entirely depopulated and so filled with enemies, it was necessary that we should have protection." Still scantily clad in skins, the four survivors arrived in Compostela, where a circumspect Nuño de Guzmán greeted them. Their adjustment to European life had been halting. After years of living simply and in the open, such Spanish customs as donning a full complement of clothes with stockings, handkerchiefs, rosaries, and perhaps a shoulder cape appeared cumbersome to the survivors. The governor gave them clothes from his own wardrobe, a gesture that may have been prompted partly by his puritanical sensibilities. "I was unable to wear the clothes for many days," Cabeza de Vaca writes, "nor were we able to sleep but on the ground." The survivors were dismayed by the extensive slaving and human suffering and raised the subject with the prickly Guzmán. But the governor became displeased and promptly dispatched the castaways to Mexico City. Cabeza de Vaca and his companions stayed in Compostela for 2 weeks before departing for Mexico City with their small entourage of loyal Indians. When they arrived on Sunday, July 23, 1536, the citizens of the capital were in high spirits. It was the eve of the Day of St. James, and the city residents were preparing for a series of bullfights and juegos de caña, jousting matches. The arrival of the four heroes contributed greatly to the expansive mood. Viceroy Don Antonio de Mendoza and the Marqués del Valle Hernán Cortés warmly received the four wanderers, giving them food and clothes. The survivors could not help but become pawns in a power struggle. The viceroy and the marquis were rivals, and the survivors' unexpected arrival would plunge them into a headlong competition over the exploration of the vast lands north from Mexico. The value of what the wanderers knew was incalculable. Mendoza did everything he could to attract them to his camp. He opened his house and kept them as honored guests. He also agreed to look after the few dozen Indians from the north that Cabeza de Vaca and his companions had brought. In return, Viceroy Mendoza was able to question the four men in the comfort of his home and even asked them to draw a map of all the lands they had visited. As the celebrations unfolded, Mexico City succumbed to a newfound fever to explore those marvelous regions of which the castaways spoke. Unwittingly, the castaways had ushered in yet another wave of conquests. Epilogue. Cabeza de Vaca, Castillo, Durantes, and Estebanico had journeyed to the New World as settlers. As they set off from Spain, They must have imagined themselves leading simple lives in incipient communities in Florida, making do with whatever foods, building materials, and friendships their immediate surroundings afforded them. Certainly they never expected to find themselves spending close to a year in Mexico City, subjected to constant scrutiny and attention. But the four survivors had become a sensation. They were feted and paraded around town. They had even appeared in one of the main city churches, stark naked, but for the deerskins covering their private parts, startling details that Mexico City residents would still remember a generation later. With all the pageantry and commotion that surrounded them, the travelers must have been hard-pressed at first to reflect on their odyssey and on their hopes for the future. Of the four, Cabeza de Vaca was the one who had found his calling. He intended to go back to Spain to submit a report to the emperor. It was his duty as royal treasurer. But since Narváez was dead, Cabeza de Vaca also hoped to use the occasion to petition for the vacant adelantamiento. The royal treasurer's plan was not outlandish. He was deserving and loyal, and his story would leave little doubt among court members that he had earned his reward with sweat and blood. But far more importantly, Cabeza de Vaca believed that his peaceful ascendancy over the Indians of North America would sway the members of the Spanish court into believing that a more humane kind of colonial occupation was achievable. Instead of enslaving Indians and torching villages as Núñez de Guzmán was doing, the royal treasurer would make a case for establishing a partnership with them. Over the course of his journeys, Cabeza de Vaca had found that America's bounty consisted not only of gold and silver, but also of land and good people. Together, Europeans and Native Americans could make the New World yield spiritual as well as material wealth. Such a proposition would appear woefully idealistic and impracticable, but when coming from one of the children of the sun, the crown might find it worth considering. The royal treasurer understood the fears and hopes of the natives better than any other Spaniard, and perhaps had already talked to them about such a grandiose alliance. Cabeza de Vaca stayed in Mexico City for 2 months in order to regain strength and reacquaint himself with the affairs of the empire. The most intriguing news came out of Peru. In 1532, Francisco Pizarro had come in contact with the Inca, and in short order had captured its leader and demanded a room full of silver for his release. More recently, however, the situation had taken a turn for the worse. Over the summer of 1536, Pizarro frantically requested reinforcements from Guatemala and New Spain. Men of enterprise in Mexico City eagerly discussed whether there was any silver left in Peru, tantalizing talk of plunder and war that nonetheless must have been unsettling for someone advocating a peaceful colonization of America. In the fall of 1536, Cabeza de Vaca went to Veracruz seeking passage to Europe. The natural elements continued to dog him. He learned at the Mexican port that the ship that he intended to board had capsized in a storm. He could have waited for another ship, but it would be winter by the time it arrived, a dangerous time to be sailing across the Atlantic. Forced to spend the winter in Mexico City, Cabeza de Vaca made a second attempt to sail in February. That time he succeeded, but at great peril. Near the island of Bermuda, 600 miles from the coast of America, a powerful storm nearly sank his ship. To make matters worse, some days later, French privateers caught up with the lone vessel as it negotiated the Azores. The ship carried gold and silver amounting to 300,000 pesos, a worthy prize. During an agonizing afternoon and an entire night of terrible forebodings, the French corsairs pursued their prey, cutting it off but postponing the final assault until the morning. Only the miraculous appearance of a Portuguese fleet prevented the final coup. Cabeza de Vaca gave thanks to God for having escaped the hardships of the land and the perils of the sea. In August 1537, after an absence of a decade, the royal treasurer finally set foot on European soil. The ship arrived in Lisbon, from where Cabeza de Vaca traveled to Castile to settle his long-neglected affairs. By December, he was at court in Valladolid, delivering his report to the king. Cabeza de Vaca was in for a terrible disappointment. In Valladolid, he learned that the crown had already given away the commission for the conquest of Florida. In an instant, his cherished plans, long harbored during his travels in North America and in the months that he had stayed in Mexico City, came to naught. The king had foreclosed the destiny that God had intended for the royal treasurer. Cabeza de Vaca apparently had trouble letting go of his vision of peaceful colonization of the lands of North America. He sought out the man who had received the royal license for Florida, Hernando de Soto, to discuss the possibility of a partnership. But ultimately, they could not come to an agreement. Their differences had been ostensibly over money, but Cabeza de Vaca also admitted that he did not wish to go under the banner of another. It must have been exceedingly difficult for the castaway to come to terms with his diminution in status from powerful healer to mere second in command of another grasping conquistador. It would take Cabeza de Vaca 3 more years of patient lobbying to secure an adelantamiento in his own right. He would be going to the Rio de la Plata at the other end of the hemisphere in what are now portions of Argentina, Uruguay, and Paraguay. The brand new governor must have experienced a sense of déjà vu as he sailed toward the coast of South America in 1540 to begin asserting his control. At last, he would put his plan for the new world into effect. His methods of conquest were decidedly unconventional. Instead of riding on horseback, Cabeza de Vaca went barefoot ahead of his men, calling out to the Indians of the region, the Guarani, and trying to lure them gently. He gave out gifts to the Guarani and ordered his men to pay scrupulously for all the goods received from them. To prevent any abuses, Cabeza de Vaca always set up his camp away from native villages and allowed his men to trade with the Indians only through a licensed agent. Cabeza de Vaca's men did not appreciate these methods. The European residents of the Rio de la Plata had their own ideas about how to treat Indians and profit at their expense. Having lived in the area before Cabeza de Vaca's arrival, most of them came to resent this curious leader who behaved more like a missionary than a conquistador. There were rumblings of rebellion. Perhaps more jarringly for Cabeza de Vaca, the Guarani Indians also became disaffected. They balked at his Christianizing program, which included such strictures as the eradication of cannibalism and the imposition of monogamous marriage. By the spring of 1544, Cabeza de Vaca's men had had enough. They seized the governor and sent him back to Spain, accused of charges ranging from confiscating the property of dead European residents to not bringing sufficient supplies to Paraguay, to forbidding Europeans to trade freely with the Indians and thus reducing them to poverty, to delivering 25 friendly Indians to the Guaranis to be killed and eaten. Cabeza de Vaca's forced return to Spain was a time of reckoning for him. His colonization project in South America had been a utopian dream. It was one thing to wield the power of an indigenous shaman, and quite another to act as the leader of a band of conquerors. His extraordinary experiences in North America had given him a false sense of what he could accomplish at the Rio de la Plata. At the very least, he had grossly overestimated his influence. Cabeza de Vaca had been unable to control his men and to persuade the Indians that they would be better off under Spain's tutelage. Gentle and well-intentioned as he may have been, a conquest was still a conquest after all. Cabeza de Vaca's subsequent legal ordeal lasted 8 long years after his imprisonment in South America. He faced 4 different lawsuits and more than 30 criminal charges. In 1551, the Council of the Indies found Cabeza de Vaca guilty. He was banned in perpetuity from the Indies and stripped of all his titles. In addition, he was sentenced to 5 years in a penal colony in Oran, in present-day Algeria. It was a precipitous fall for someone who had once wielded the power to cure the Indians and had been treated like a demigod. Cabeza de Vaca fought back, appealing his sentence and calling witnesses who spoke in his favor. In 1552, the most onerous portions of his sentence were rescinded or reduced, and by 1555, he had come close to achieving complete vindication. Cabeza de Vaca chose to spend the last years of his life in his ancestral village of Jerez de la Frontera, like his grandfather, the conqueror of Gran Canaria. In his ripe old age, the wanderer of North America and former governor of the Rio de la Plata became a larger-than-life figure and protector of his family. In 1559, the castaway signed a bond for a ransom payment on behalf of Hernán Ruiz Cabeza de Vaca, a relative who was being held captive by the King of Algiers. But in the end, Cabeza de Vaca must have reflected on the fact that, unlike his grandfather, he had never attained the glitter of successful conquest. All along, he had been a more tragic figure, an orphan, a self-made man, a visionary, a fervent Catholic, and a consummate survivor who had overcome the most adverse circumstances while holding fast to his ideals. Andrés Dorantes and Alonso del Castillo, the other two European castaways, had less difficulty readjusting to colonial life. They followed a markedly different trajectory than their former royal treasurer. They decided to stay in New Spain, continuing their dealings with Native Americans, no longer as medicine men, but as colonial officials and wealthy residents. Their transformation from ragged shamans to men of means was the handiwork of Don Antonio de Mendoza. As Dorantes' son would explain decades later, Viceroy Mendoza took Captains Dorantes and Castillo into his household, honoring them and marrying them to widows. Viceroy Mendoza proved to be a wily matchmaker. Within months of his arrival in Mexico City, he married Castillo to Doña Isabel de Sanabria, the wealthy widow of a deceased conquistador. Castillo thus gained an instant stake in the wealth of New Spain, and Doña Isabel, a trophy husband, part miracle man from an illustrious Spanish family. 4 years later, Castillo and his wife appeared as co-owners of an encomienda, comprising fully half of the town of Tehuacán, located at the heart of a large valley of rolling hills about 100 miles to the southeast of Mexico City. The Indians who lived there were entrusted to the Spanish couple. They would continue to live in their own community, but would also be obligated to give tribute to Captain Castillo and Doña Isabel, who could then sell these agricultural products at a profit. In return, Castillo and his wife had to make sure that the Indians thus entrusted to them received proper religious instruction. Captain Dorantes took more time to settle down. Early in 1537, he made an unsuccessful attempt to go back to Spain. For much of that year, he also considered going back to the north as the leader of a swift exploratory expedition that would be sponsored by Viceroy Mendoza. But ultimately, Dorantes followed in Castillo's footsteps and married a wealthy widow, Doña María de la Torre. Dorantes held jointly with his wife an encomienda in Atzalán Mexcalcingo, to the east of Mexico City. According to a 1560 estimate, the grant comprised 1,608 Indians and yielded a tribute in cotton, honey, beans, ají, chili peppers, chickens, fish, and maize. Perhaps the castaways' intimate knowledge of the Indians of the North influenced how they treated those entrusted to them in central Mexico. It is impossible to tell from the sources. Most likely, Castillo and Dorantes acted like typical encomenderos, neither more benevolently nor more cruelly than others. In any case, neither was involved in the day-to-day management of their Indian grants, as both became absentee owners. Castillo and Dorantes adapted well to their new lives, alternating the management of their encomiendas with courtly life in Mexico City, the vice-regal capital. Castillo received a one-year appointment as alcalde ordinario, ordinary mayor of Mexico City. By 1547, Castillo felt sufficiently knowledgeable and meritorious to request a position as councilman of Mexico City, one of the most coveted offices in all of New Spain. His request was turned down. The peripatetic Dorantes accepted riskier assignments. According to his son, Captain Dorantes assisted in the settlement of areas inhabited by fierce Indians where no Spaniards lived. Interestingly, Dorantes had occasion to return to the province of Nueva Galicia, where the castaways had first encountered the Spanish slavers after their incredible adventures in the interior. Nueva Galicia experienced a massive Indian insurrection in 1541-1542 that nearly succeeded in dislodging the Spanish presence there. Viceroy Mendoza had to request thousands of volunteers from central Mexico and personally led these forces into this northwestern province to put down the movement. The viceroy must have greatly appreciated the services of Captain Dorantes, who was both familiar with the region and well acquainted with the Indians there. No sources shed light on whether Dorantes ever attempted to use his past influence over the Indians to bring about peace. Unlike Cabeza de Vaca's fitful re-immersion into the imperial world, Dorantes and Castillo throve in Mexico's colonial society. With the passage of time, these two Spaniards must have taken for granted their sense of belonging to the powerful encomendero class and their right to demand tribute and labor from the Indians. They became respectable heads of households, property owners, and esteemed leaders. Their dreams of carving a place for themselves in the New World had come true. Of the four castaways, Estebanico was the only one who returned to the vast lands of North America. The furor caused by the arrival of the castaways in Mexico City prompted Viceroy Mendoza to enter the field of discovery. In 1537, he decided to send an expedition to the far north. Yet one by one, each of the survivors declined to join this new venture. Cabeza de Vaca may have been already too keen on returning to Spain. Castillo, yearning for a more stable existence, probably decided early on to stay in New Spain. Dorantes remained the viceroy's most promising prospect. "I spoke with him many times," Mendoza would later write to the emperor, "because it seemed to me that it could be of much service to your majesty to send him with 40 or 50 horsemen to learn the secret of those regions." The viceroy spent a great deal of money making the necessary arrangements. Yet something happened toward the end of 1537, or early in 1538, that changed Dorantes' mind. Viceroy Mendoza's last hope was Estebanico. He spoke to Dorantes about securing the services of the Moroccan, but the captain reportedly experienced deep grief at the thought of parting with Estebanico. Despite the vast social differences and the inequality of their relationship, a strong bond of comradeship must have united these two men. Don Antonio Mendoza sent 500 pesos on a silver plate, but Dorantes refused his generous offer. In the end, Dorantes surrendered his dear slave to the viceroy without payment because of the potential benefits to Spain and to the Indians of North America. The North African did not have a choice in the matter, yet, considering his subsequent behavior, he may have actually welcomed the idea. Estebanico departed from Mexico City in 1538, guiding a reconnaissance party headed by a Franciscan friar named Marcos de Niza. After reaching Culiacán, they pushed farther north in early 1539, leaving behind the last European settlement. The Indians immediately recognized Estebanico. His skin color would have been unmistakable, and gave him turquoise and women. Estebanico's insistence on keeping these presents, especially the women, caused some consternation among Fray Marcos de Niza and his fellow friars. But Estebanico must have felt sufficiently secure to persist. To keep the disapproving friars at arm's length, the Moroccan ventured ahead of them at a considerable distance. After crossing an unsettled land, or despoblado, with only the women and a few Indian auxiliaries, he ran into another group of Indians, possibly in what is now northern Sonora. Confident and unconcerned, Estevanico candidly explained to these Indians that he was the harbinger of a group of white men sent by a great lord, and that they were coming to instruct them about things divine. Even more brazenly, Estevanico asked for more turquoise and women. The Indians had nothing to gain from Estevanico's embassy. They deliberated for 3 days about what to do, and finally chose to kill him. According to a later description, he ended his days full of arrows, like a Saint Sebastian. Too late, he must have realized his monumental blunder. Only a set of extraordinary circumstances had preserved Estevanico's fragile existence up until that point. And what could have occurred at any moment of the last 10 years at last came to pass. Estevanico had come far, farther than any of the other men on this journey. Born in Morocco, enslaved in Europe, re-enslaved in North America, worshipped as a child of the sun, enslaved yet again in Mexico City, and at last, given relative freedom to lead a band of Europeans into the strange lands where his remarkable life would come to an end.
This has been an Audible Inc. production of A Land So Strange, The Epic Journey of Cabeza de Vaca, written by Andres Resendez, narrated by Jonathan Davis. Executive producer, Christina Harkar. Producer, Mike Charzik. Music by Michael Whalen. Copyright 2007 by Andres Resendez. Production copyright 2011 by Audible Inc.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.